If there is one Sunday during the Revised Common Lectionary cycle that ought to be called Wisdom Sunday, this is it. We have two scripture readings from the Hebrew scriptures this morning because they are, at least from my position, culturally pivotal stories regarding wisdom. And secondly, the one from the book of Proverbs is a rare inclusion of that book in the lectionary cycle. Only two Sundays out of 3 years, I can do this, has something from the book of Proverbs. It's worth paying attention to it because it locates the source of wisdom emanating from the feminine presence of all that is holy. Now, that does not mean that all women are wise and that all men are simpletons. I'm not going to go there. But it does suggest in a world dominated by patriarchy that the biblical source of wisdom is too often not even present in the discussion about what to do next in the world. I sat for, 2 days this week not wanting to talk about what I'm going to talk about next. But it must be noted, I think, and added to our awareness if we're going to risk being sincere and wise men and women of faith. Because it's every parent's worst nightmare. It ought to be, but sadly is often not every church leader's worst nightmare. And if you are both a parent and a church leader like I am, you are literally sick over this. The revelation that hundreds of clergy in Pennsylvania sexually abused more than 1,000 children over the span of several decades. This is not going to be any, there will be no Catholic bashing here. More than 1,000 kids, though. I have to spell that out, and I got to say it out loud, and I still quite can't let my head and my heart wrap around the vastness of it, because if I did, I don't think I could sleep. And I want to say this right up front. Not all priests or clergy are pedophiles, right? And not all pedophiles are priests or clergy. Most priests and clergy are faithful, loving influences and would cut off their own hand before they would think of harming a child. And Lord knows, there are plenty of sexual predators out there roaming the world who have no ties to a church. The two designations do not go hand in hand. But for this particular set of crimes, the church, and I include us in that, the church is not merely a backdrop. The Catholic Church and the church institutions in general that we are part of and corporations have played a vital role in perpetuating these crimes. Not just in creating the space for the abuse, but in setting up a whole culture that both creates and enables predators. There is evidence that church authorities often work to cover up these crimes, to silence victims, to keep the offenders in their places of service, or to send them quietly off to another church where they weren't known. It's unthinkable. But above all, this most recent scandal is an indictment of religion and its embrace of patriarchy, its faithfulness to male power and authority over and above the rights of women and children, and the idolization of that masculine image over and above any true image of the divine. The subconscious message that follows is that men are somehow God or Christ fill-ins. Children are especially vulnerable to the implication that we clergy have some sort of godlike authority. My daughter will tell you I don't. Any religious doctrine that upholds the authority of men over women is setting itself up to be an accessory to abuse. If you say that women can't preach, you are essentially saying that women are not equal to men. When you say that women are not equal to men, then we create space for men to abuse women and children. And in the case of the Catholic Church, and in much of conservative fundamentalist Protestantism, priests and clergy have a mantle of authority that is granted solely to men. That authority is unquestioned. And this is the perfect example of how that kind of gender authority is simply toxic, not just to women, but to men as well. And in no way, as I say that, do I want to say that priests are the victims here. The children are the victims. And the clergy must be held accountable, full stop. But instead of saying that these priests are evil monsters, we need to recognize that they are sick. And this particular sickness was inflicted on them, at least in part, by a religious institution that does not value the whole person, or its leaders, or its members. And I include us in that. This system doesn't value, often enough, the voice of women, nor does it value women's bodies. Let's talk about the teaching that the Catholic Church is so infamous for of natural family planning, for one thing, and how that essentially, I will argue, takes all the fun out of sex for women. That is just one way that the church attempts to control women's bodies and sexuality. And in demanding celibacy from its priests, Catholic doctrine further devalues the body and its needs, putting such shame around sexual desire. And the body itself is bound to lead to all kinds of ugly stuff popping out. And that shame and repression to the absolute nature, add that shame and repression to the absolute nature of male authority and the history of priests having access to children, it's a recipe for disaster. And disaster is exactly what's been wrought on far too many lives. Patriarchy is a problem for women and children, and for men as well, whether they are religious leaders or not. And again, hear me say that not all priests are predators, but given the astounding number of instances in which the church is complicit in this kind of abuse, it's high time for all of our churches to take a look inward at how we might be enabling systems that put vulnerable people at risk. That means having safe spaces and practices in place to protect our children and youth, and properly screening any staff or volunteers who are going to interact with them in the context of church activities. If your religious organization, if you're not from here, doesn't have these boundaries firmly in place already, it's imperative that you stand for them to do so. And equally important, it is crucial that you and I are prepared to believe that it can easily happen in our schools, in our families, in our businesses, and even to us. Physical and sexual abuse happens from strangers. But a vast majority of the time, abuse happens at the hands of a family member, an extended family member, like a friend, or a clergy, or a teacher, or a coach. I don't want to look at every person as a potential abuser. But I realize that we have to be open to the probabilities and not end up like those we see time after time in interviews saying, oh, I just never in a million years thought that person was capable of doing such things. Really? We are all capable. And some people are so damaged that they relatively easily hurt others. It is being an abuser as unsurprising to me as is the reality that bad storms happen in Indiana, metaphorically or practically. Bad stuff happening should be anticipated as a common reality. Most of us buy insurance because we understand that bad stuff happens. Creating as much safety from storm damage is normal because we know a storm's going to come through and hail damage will put holes in our roof. We must be as consciously aware that our children are at risk of being abused as our roofs are at risk from storm damage. Being consciously aware does not mean that we are devaluing trusting. It means that we have the active wisdom to read the realities of danger that does come from those we allow to be close to our children. Wisdom prevents us from being blind to ugly realities and probably saves our children more than we know. We pay our child care workers here at church about, $14 an hour, I think. Not a bad wage. When we have meetings, we offer child care, and if we know that only one kid is going to be here, we still pay two people according to our church policy, because we know that two sets of eyes prevents us from being personally or organizationally blind to the ugly realities of abuse. We also run all of our child care workers through the criminal database system. But protecting children and women from abuse also means eliminating the message of absolute male authority. It's a dangerous ethos that needs to be rooted out of culture in general and eliminated from the Christian narrative in particular. Patriarchy hurts everyone, even men. There is nothing biblical. Oh, there's so much biblical, isn't there? Supporting patriarchy. But as men and women of the progressive faith movement, you need to become avid interpreters of our Bible's most provocative places that promote patriarchy. Our Bible is full of it, but most of the time, it takes but a few moments to discover on our own and lead others to discover how utterly self and culturally defeating patriarchy really is. Just pay attention to this morning's reading about King Solomon. Was there anyone wiser than Solomon in all of his glory? Well, the correct answer is yes, just about anybody. But you would not think it or believe it if you only read the spin about Solomon. And it is not the biblical writers that did all the spinning about biblical Solomon's greatness. It has been patriarchy itself that has failed to teach the rest of the story about Solomon. Once upon a time, there lived a young prince. And when Solomon's father died, King David, he ordered the murder of his older brother, the rightful heir to the throne, and took over the kingdom by stealth and bloodshed. And after spending the early days of his reign carrying out the vengeance killings his father had requested, he then set out to build the kingdom of his dreams, a kingdom of wealth, prestige, power. The king's appetites were beyond excessive. To support his extravagant lifestyle, he levied taxes his subjects could not bear. To police knowledge, he gathered the surrounding world's wisdom and attached his name to him. To complete his lavish building projects, he drafted thousands of people into forced labor. To satisfy his lusts, he assembled a harem of 700 wives, 300 concubines. To quell his spiritual restlessness, he constructed pagan shrines. He offered worship to gods who demanded child sacrifice. The results of his choices were dire. By the end of Solomon's reign, his people could no longer bear the crushing burdens of taxation and slavery that he had placed upon them. This is all in the Bible, incidentally. In the wake of his paganism, they could no longer differentiate what was true worship, because he had monopolized God to justify his personal brand of wisdom. His subjects had nowhere to turn when they sought divine discernment. The king soon found himself confronted by his enemies, and after his untimely death, Solomon's son tried to force the disgruntled masses back into servitude, but they resisted. In a civil war that would last for decades broke out, the kingdom was split in two, and the famed king's once golden dreams dissolved into chaos. One king, two radically different stories. Which story tells the truth about Solomon? Which story tells the truth about you, about me? I have precise memories of sitting in church as a child, watching preachers like me twist themselves into interpretive puzzles, pretzels, to make sure the famed king emerged from their sermons with his reputation intact as the wisest man who ever lived. In those sermons, I didn't hear about the slaves who toiled in the king's copper mines and stone yards, or about the excesses of Solomon's daily menu. The Bible says he needed 1,000 measures of flour and meal, 10 oxen, 20 cattle, 100 sheep, and ample sides of deer, gazelle, roebuck, and fatted fowl. I didn't hear about his forbidden gods that he honored with dubious and possible sinister sacrifices at the shrines out on the outskirts of town. I did, however, hear preachers make the time-honored, let's blame Eve. Let's blame the women to clean up Solomon's dubious moral life. This move allowed Solomon to remain a wise and good king, a witty and enterprising man, whose only, his only fatal mistake was that he fell into the arms of the wrong women. Foreign, immigrant, adulterous women who led his otherwise pure heart astray. Poor man. Needless to say, this misogynistic reading depended on a pretty narrow definition of sin. Sin as a sexual mishap, not sin as greed, fratricide, gluttony, exploitation, cruel indifference. It is possible to lose God's dream for us in ours. Solomon may well have received a vision from God. Most of us do, I think. But in the end, it doesn't matter. What matters is that Solomon's own dreams very quickly left God in the dust. Walter Brueggemann puts it this way, and I quote, "The wisdom that Solomon does not learn, the wisdom that Solomon does not learn is attentiveness to those for whom God has special attentiveness. There are all kinds of dreams of power, money, prestige, and control, but the dream of justice for widows, orphans, immigrants is the deep wisdom of the Hebrew Scriptures," end quote. And that's the dream. God's dream for the least and the most vulnerable of his children that Solomon never even comes close to fulfilling. Wealth is not a blessing. I feel like I need to repeat that. Wealth is not a blessing. If wealth is a blessing, then Jesus must be regarded as one of the most unblessed people ever to walk the earth. He lived and died dirt poor. But if there's one false teaching that haunts the American church most, this is it. That money is somehow an unambiguous sign of God's approval for our lives the way they are. Hence, prosperity theology. Hence, our willingness to turn a blind eye to the sin in our politicians, our economic policymakers, our religious leaders, and our cultural icons when their sins come packaged in enormous wealth. Too often, money has a tendency to create a moral vacuum. Solomon remained wealthy while he sacrificed babies. Wealth is not a blessing. So let's tell the story one more time. Once upon a time, there lived a king. He had big dreams, as most of us do. He had great faults, as most of us do. He yearned at times for the best of things, wisdom, discernment, and a sound mind. And he lusted at other times for the worst. He lived a life marked by success, failure, nobility, and disgrace. He loved God, and he didn't. He pleased God, and he didn't. He left a legacy that was neither perfect nor wretched, as most of us will. But he was loved by God throughout, even when his foolish wisdom shattered God's heart. And so are we, so loved. We need to remember God's dream for us, as well as relish in God's love. And remember the wisdom of what it is that God requires of us. To love mercy, to do justice, and to walk humbly.